Okay, over to you.
Okay. So, hello everyone. Welcome to the 70th webinar on the secret teachings of all ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series is available on Makara.us under the subheadings Moria Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress. Previous episodes of this, The Secret Doctrine, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view. You can join any of these webinars on the homepage of the Moria Federation up here in the upper left-hand corner. Yeah, just click and it'll bring up a link in case you lost your invitation or at the last minute you want to get in. You can always do it through moriafederation.com. So, okay, well, we're still in this rather detailed chapter on what Manly P. Hall calls the Bimbing Table of Isis, though it's actually, I'm finding, much more commonly known as the Mensa Isiaka. So we began our last session by exploring the fundamental elements, cross, circle, and half circle, that make up the astrological glyphs for Venus, Mercury, Saturn, and Jupiter, examining the unique significance that each shape holds within these symbols. In this study, we learned that the cross represents structure, matter, and the fixed organizing principle underlying the physical universe, including the four elements and the cardinal directions defining time and space. The circle or solar disk represents the spirit aspect, unity, the totality of existence, and the primordial source from which all things emerge. And the crescent represents receptivity, intuition, and the ever unfolding dynamic quality of the life aspect. So last time we applied these ideas to these four symbols and how they might describe the signs. So you can go to the last webinar if you're interested in that. We then returned to the Mensa Isiaka, where we discovered that the Hebrew simple letters correspond to the lower register of the frieze, the seven double letters to the central register of the frieze, and the three mother letters to the three ophite, meaning serpent, figures in the central panel. Using Levi's chart, shown here below, this is just a segment, we were also able to identify the planets associated with the gods and goddesses in this most important middle register. In his The Isiac Table, Westcott relates each god and goddess in this middle register with their planet, their Hebrew letter, and overall quality or dominant quality. Quote, the seven doubles, which correspond to the planets, talking about the Hebrew letters, and the median part of the Isiac tablet are Luna, associated with the Hebrew letter Beth and the attribute nature, Mars, associated with the letter Gimel and force, the Sun, associated with the letter Daleth and fertility, Venus, associated with the letter Kaf and generation, Mercury, associated with the letter Pe and wisdom, Saturn, associated with the letter Resh and peace, and Jupiter, associated with the letter Tao and beauty. We then further explored the identity of the central figure, which Levi relates to the Roman goddess Alps and MPH to the Greek goddess Rea. Next, we take a look at the overall layout of an Egyptian temple, learning that passage from the forecourt through the hypostyle hall, ending in the sanctuary, was constructed to mirror the journey of the sun god Ra across the heavens and through the Duat, or underworld. That's why this boat is here. Focusing in on the friezes in these temples, MPH tells us that there are images of the gods in concatenated series, accompanied by magical inscriptions. So often these series appear in horizontal bands on temple walls. I've been to Egypt three times, walked among the temples, and you see this a lot where the gods appear all in a row like this. And they're usually depicting some specific ritual, cosmological or genealogical order. For example, the Ogduad or Khmun, that's what this is, in the Pranos and Pronaos at the Temple of Hathor, and the 42 assessors of the dead in the Hall of Maat, where you have all these figures that are shown identically, except for different colors, that are the assessors of the deceased. We then learned that these temples were not just places of worship, but were also mystery schools, where visual and linguistic tools were used to transmit sacred knowledge. Then MPH once again returns to the Mencia Siaka, stating in his introduction to the table, Kircher summarizes its symbolism thus. It teaches, in the first place, the whole constitution of the threefold world, archetypal, intellectual, and sensible. So Kircher is here saying that every symbol in the table maps out the unfolding of reality in three concentric realms. The highest of these is the archetypal, the realm of divine ideas, which corresponds to Plato's realm of perfect, unchanging prototypes, the blueprints from which all things derive. On the tablet, this sphere is represented by the highest register of figures, which symbolize cosmic principles and primordial deities. Actually, the ultimate source, which is not being described right here, but will be a little later on, is the pure or absolute spirit source, which is represented by the Isis-like central figure. But back to these guys, these are, quote, the governors of the world, each with its fiery ethereal insignia. A second realm, represented by the central register, is that of the divine intellect, where mind or nous contemplates and shapes the archetypes into intelligible patterns. This is the realm, excluding the central figure, by the way. This is the realm of abstract thought, divine intellect, and the ordering principles that structure the cosmos. A study of the grouping of gods, geometric forms, and combinations of symbols reveals specific ways in which expressions of the divine mind are encoded. The third order is the sensible realm, representing the physical universe accessible to our five senses, matter, nature, and the visible world. Here, the archetypal and intellectual forces descend into form, giving rise to the planets, elements, plants, animals, and human beings. In contradistinction to the governors of the world found in the upper register, we have the fathers of the fountains portrayed in the lower register. These fathers are custodians of the primal springs from which all life and form emerges. They ensure that the archetypal principles, the metaphysical waters or ideas, remain pure and ever flowing. They also maintain the fixed rhythms, the daily and annual motions of the sun, moon, and stars that uphold cosmic beauty and harmony. And this pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. So next up, MPH lists the names of the 15 triads illustrated in the Mensa Isiaca. We've touched on many of these, so here I'll just do a quick review in order to gain a more cohesive understanding of the entire table and how the triads interrelate with each other. So in the upper tier, we have the constellations, which MPH describes as the governors of the world who aid Father Mind, represented by the central figure, in control of the universe. The first of these higher four is the Mendesian triad. Mendes means winter, which includes the signs Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces. The goat on the altar, a symbol of Capricorn, refers to the fecundity of the earth, ready to nourish the germs of growth. As you remember, Capricorn is right at the winter solstice at the turning of the sun northward. It was customary to sacrifice goats at the winter solstice as an appeal for a favorable growing season. Next is the Ammonian or spring triad, represented by the signs Aries, Taurus, and Gemini. The ram Ammon, seen above, standing by a plant with three fructifying branches, is a symbol of the intense and ripening heat of the season. The Zohar says, to denote heat, they drew a ram, the horns diverging upwards being types of flames or fire. Of course, the ram is animal associated with Aries, which is a fire sign. The third triad is the Momphtian triad, Momphta being the name for summer, whose signs are Cancer, Leo, and Virgo. The pater of this triad, the father's aspect, is the goddess Nephta. And when I said father aspect, it's really the leading or conditioning aspect. So we have here Nephta, which is often identified with Isis. On the pedestal is a winged Leonian lion, the symbol of Momphta, who the Egyptians identified with the rising Nile. The final triad in the upper register is the Omphtian or autumn triad, whose signs include Libra, Scorpio, and Sagittarius. Omphta, a beneficent deity, is the protector of the sign Libra, ruling when the land of Egypt is filled with moisture after the inundation of the Nile. In the center section, we first have the Isiac triad, shown up here, directly above the Hecatine. In it, we see the white and black bull Menevis, who is the fecund lunar deity of omnipotent nature, especially in relation to agriculture. Remember, a lot of this was developed during the Taurian age, even though this tablet itself was made during the Piscean age, it refers back to a Taurian time. Hence, we have so many orientations towards Taurus and the bull as a symbol. The attendant on the far right is Triptolemus, holding a cup and a bovine phallus. The attendant on the left is Maro. According to Kircher, the words above read, the propagator of the celestial fluid to lower beings. So the bull was seen as a source, one of the sources of nature, often is associated with Isis, you know, where you have a bull head with the horns and the solar or lunar disc in between the horns, and Isis is often depicted same with those horns and that orb between, suggesting that both represent a kind of natural source, a source for nature itself, really. So beneath the Isiak is the Hecatine triad, which is inexplicably mislabeled by Levi, since we haven't yet read about this triad, let's take a closer look. Could we get a reader, please?
Sure, I'll start off.
Okay, great.
The Azonian Hecatine Triad, LMN. This triad contains three mentes named in Greek.
Trisidota.
And Veronica.
Triacidotis, Comas, and Eclustike.
Okay. The center of all influxes is denoted by the head M, female with black veil and white ears, three necklets, and a great doorway of the world on her head. She is Isis under the form of Hecate, a type of the great Potter. Her white ears are canine. The dog was sacred to her. She was the faithful guardian and preserver of earthly treasures. Because the sensible world is subject to many changes, it is marked by the lotus-flowered column. By it are two heliotrope flowers denoting the solar motion, and the particolored column also points out the alternating states caused by the solar motion. The column stands in a cordiform, heart-shaped pedestal for a mysterious reason. The attendants L and N were called by Stellus, Trichotis, and Comas. Their breasts are pendulous with the abundance of milk. They have triple collars relating to the animal, vegetable, and mineral natures.
Thank you, BL. Okay. Okay, so any thoughts or questions about this? It's called the Hecatine Triad. Next is the Ibimorphous Triad. Somebody's mic is on.
No, it's Ben just
go ahead.
Blanching about that former picture. The woman's head. The woman's head in the center is Hathor, the cow-eared goddess, and the two figures that are identical are Hapi, the intersex god of the inundation of the Nile.
Yeah, good observation. Yeah, this is Hecate, this head.
It's Hathor.
Yeah.
It's Hathor.
Oh, okay.
yeah, I just couldn't.
Hathor, part of the triad that, you know, Hecate is often shown in relation to Hathor as the kind of underworld version of her. Here, Westcott has her ears as being canine rather than the bull ears. It's fascinating triad figure, deeply symbolic, and has a mirror on the other side.
And Hapi is now the inundation of the Nile and the rising of Sirius.
No, I just thought of this, that the mm-hmm. column kind of looks like a Nile stick, you know, where they measured the depth of the Nile, I wonder. So, thanks, Ben. So next is this ibomorphous triad. The central figure represents Hermanubis. We've talked about this, and so I'll just identify it. Yeah, we read about all this earlier. His ibis head represents the deity of moisture. His tessellated chair points out the ever-changing states of nature, day and night, heat and cold, etc. Next, the Ophionic. So it's not the Isis in the center, but the serpent forms that surround her. Triad made up of the serpent dragons on either side of the IYNX, and the Sphinx, as well as the Sphinx-like figure beneath her throne. These three represent the pantomorphous spirit. Pantomorphous means existing in all shapes and forms. So the pantomorphous spirit of the world, acting in the intellectual, ethereal, and elementary spheres. So it's basically the energy which emanates in its source form or pure form from the IYNX and then is transmitted as a triad of energies through these serpent-like figures. Next, we have the Nephthian triad representing the feminine and passive, but it's not feminine in all situations, for the Egyptians considered their deities to be asexual and thus able to become either active or passive, male or female, as circumstances required. Sometimes they would give a different name to the male or female version of that same god, but recognizing, unlike, modern theology, recognizing that they were really two aspects of a more fundamental being. Next, we have this Serapion triad, which Levi has again reversed, basically just reversed Serapis and Hecate in the chart. This triad is named from the monstrously shaped head in the upper central area. Serapis is the name of the sun when it is below the horizon. It was also a god adored and seen as the savior, sort of the Egyptian Christ, in Alexandria, in the very late period, in the very late Egyptian period. I think even after, interestingly, after this tablet was formulated, because Egypt did continue for a couple of 3 centuries, two and a half centuries after the birth of Christ. Serapis is the name of the sun, as I said, it's the name of the sun below the horizons, which Greeks called Pluto, and Dis, Dis, exercising authority over all the lower world. On his head are the three feathers of the triform deity. At lower left is a frog sitting on a Persian flower, and at lower right is a cynocephalus with a moon above its head. Cynocephalus is a dog-headed entity related to Anubis and the subterranean or night cycle. So this whole thing, including this being, for lack of a better word, represents the underworld. The attendants in this triad stand on either side of a lotus-flowered column, the undulating stems of which symbolize solar motion. As in the similar column of the Hecatean triad, the alternating black and white squares indicate cycles of day and night and summer and winter. You can see their similarity, but they're not identical. The final center section grouping is the Oh, yeah, here they are. You can see the difference in these two columns. Yeah, so the final center section is the Osirian triad, which is placed above the Serapion here. In this triad, we find a white bull or Apis. Just as the bull in the Isiac triad is lunar, the white bull of the Osirian triad is represented by solar energy. The first triad of the lower section is the Horian triad, Horian meaning Horus, which is also called the triad at the Great East Gate. We actually read a lot about this, so I'll just make a few comments. Here we see the boy Horus enclosed in a portico, covered in network and holding a wand with a cuckoo head and a cross upon it, and also a square and a trumpet. Behind his neck, here we go. Behind his neck hangs a triangle with a globe emerging from it. The portico is ornamented with a winged globe above and its sides with quadrified circles and five-pointed stars alternately placed, suggesting spirit and form alternately. This gate, because these enclosures were considered to be gates, admits all light. You know, this is why it's the Horian gate, all light, life, and motion, symbolized by the winged globe to the four parts of the world and to the order of beings. This particular triad is associated with the east and the source of light. Horus is the sun, which confers heat and light to our earth and rises in the east. The network points out that the sun's origin and powers are hidden from our knowledge, this netting over the body. The cross denotes its power over the four elements. The cuckoo head denotes variety of production. The square, this symbol right here, suggests order and symmetry, and the clarion represents harmony, this emblem. The second triad, named Uluromorphous Fontana or Western, is placed at the opposite end. We haven't read about these at all, but I'll still be somewhat brief compared to the information available on all of these. This is the F figure, which is the central figure, is the parens, a female figure with a cat's head. So when the pater is female, it's called, Kircher called it parens. Standing in a portico. Above is a winged globe, again, symbol of the influx of the supreme mens or divine mind. Around are quadrified circles referring to the mundane world. In her right hand is the lotus wand. In her left, the crux ansata. On her head are a globe, a scarabaeus, and serpent. In the west, the sun, leaving the upper regions, seeks the lower, and night comes on when Ellurus, the cat with eyes specially fitted for night use, becomes powerful. So you can see a tremendous balance in all these figures between the day and the night deities. The moon then supplants the sun, for the Egyptians looked upon the moon and her rays as the sun's rays reflected from a mirror. The crux ansata was a most powerful amulet against evil powers, which, of course, more powerful during the darkness. The third triad is Pandocheon, the genie of the north. The central figure is a female seated. She has full breast and holds the lotus flower wand. Her seat has a chessboard ornamentation, and her dress has a sort of crux and sata scattered over it. She is seated as a ruler of the north. Her variegated seat marks the light and shade of the northern sun. The crux and sata is needed as a protection from Typhonian powers, particularly potent in the north, in the both north and south. The lotus wand points to the archetypal sun. On the pedestal are alternate quadrified circles and sets of five lines, the Egyptian symbol for the number nine, which is associated with the north being next to 10, the complement of all good. And finally, the fourth triad is the home of the southern genie. The pater, marked phi, is seated on a throne, ornamented like the throne in the north. His right hand commands his mens, identified by the letter T. His left hand holds a papyrus stem. His head is most special, being what's called leucomorphous, or that of an hawk. He is seated as a ruler, determining the southern limits of rule. The hawk head refers to solar intelligence, life, light, and spirit. He is called Faustus, which means the heart of life. His crown is marked with many circles, which means dominion over many realms. His mens, offering him a hawk's feather and a cup of Nile water, indicating the heat-producing southern climate. The south of Egypt was always held in great veneration and was called the lamp of light and the cup of the world. And that completes our quick tour of the 15 triads that make up the Mensa Isiaca. So, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Magda, can you read that for us, please?
Of these 15 triads, Kircher writes, the figures differ from each other in eight highly important respects, i.e., according to form, position, gesture, act, raiment, headdress, staff, and lastly, according to the hieroglyphics placed around them, whether these be flowers, shrubs, small letters, or animals. These eight symbolic methods of portraying the secret powers of the figures are subtle reminders of the eight spiritual senses of a cognition by means of which the real self in man may be comprehended. To express this spiritual truth, the Buddhists use the wheel with eight spokes and raise their consciousness by means of the Noble Eightfold Path. The ornamented border enclosing the three main panels of the table contains many symbols consisting of birds, animals, reptiles, human beings, and composite forms. According to one reading of the table, this border represents the four elements. The creatures are elemental beings. According to another interpretation, the border represents the archetypal spheres. And in its frieze of composite figures are the patterns of those forms, which in various combinations will subsequently manifest themselves in the material world. The four flowers at the corners of the table are those which, because their blossoms always face the sun and follow its course across the sky, are sacred emblems of that finer part of man's nature, which delights in facing its creator.
Thank you, Magda. Okay, first, of these 15 triads, Kircher writes, the figures differ from each other in eight highly important respects. That is, according to form, position, gesture, act, raiment, which means clothing, headdress, staff, and lastly, according to the hieroglyphics placed around them, whether these be flowers, shrubs, small letters, or animals. So we have eight qualities that encode the meaning of all these figures. The first of these, which Kircher calls form, includes both gender and whether or not a figure is animal-headed. For example, the Ibimorphous triad gives us an example of both genders and the ibis-headed Hermonubus. So you have a female figure here, the male, very clearly denoted female and male, plus this Ibimorphous or ibis-headed Hermonubus. A god or goddess's form is a clue as to their identity and function. For example, both Luna and Venus, whose given attributes are nature and generation, respectively, are feminine, whereas the male Mars figure represents the very male aspect of force. The specific animal head of a god or goddess not only reveals her identity, but gives further clues as to their function and purpose. For example, the ibis-headed Hermonubus links the symbol of wisdom, which is the ibis, with the afterlife underworld guardianship of Anubis, who is always seen carrying the ansata, crux ansata. The second quality is position. The register that a figure is part of and where a figure is pictured within his or her triad determines both a god or goddess's role and their relative potency. For example, all the figures in the upper register represent constellations, called by Kircher governors of the world. A god or goddess's position in their triad determines whether they are the pater, the mens, or the potentia, with, for example, the pater always appearing as the central figure. Here are the 15 paters of the central figure of each triad. Okay, the third quality is gesture. There are two main gestures. Command, as shown by the extended hand of the central figure in the Taoistic triad, and the much, much more common gesture of praise, indicated throughout the Mensa Isiaca by the empty upraised hand. The fourth quality is the act being carried out by a god or goddess, most dramatic of which is the sacrifice of the goat at the winter solstice by the pater figure of the Mendesian or winter triad. There's some question as to whether offerings, as depicted, for example, in the Horian triad by both the Mens and the Potentia, are gestures or acts. They seem to belong to both groupings. They're both gestures, the offerings, but they're also can be seen as acts. Fifth quality is raiment or clothing, which gives strong clues as to the god or goddess's identity. For example, the deer skin worn by the men's figure in the Taoistic triad, which indicates that the solar hawk-headed god has dominion over all the kingdoms in nature. Also, the deer was associated with the south of Egypt. Among the most dramatic raiments are the long wings of the lunar and Venusian goddesses, which, according to Westcott, indicates that they are priestesses of Isis. Okay, so any thoughts or questions at all about what I've presented so far? As I say every time, dialogue is more interesting than monologue. So if you have any thoughts or questions, please speak up. I appreciated Ben's thoughts on the Hecatean triad. So yeah, if you have any ideas, let me know. Okay. The sixth quality is the headdress, which in the Mensa Isiaca are distinctive, elaborate, usually, often, that is, and mark more than perhaps any other feature, the particular qualities of the god or goddesses. For example, in the headdress of Hermanubis, the flames denote the power of heat, the serpents, life, the feathers, velocity and subtlety, and the floral center, fecundity. But as formidable as this headdress is, the most important of all the headdresses is that of the INX. Here we have the Numidian bird, which is actually a combination of vulture and ostrich, both denoting dominion and protection. Ostrich feathers are sacred to the goddess Ma'at, representing balance, truth, and the laws that hold the universe together. So they're a very natural choice for the headdress of this central figure. The smaller pair of curved elements sitting on the back of the Numidian bird, these guys, looks a little bit like feathers, but they're actually stylized ram's horns. At least that's what the Westcott believes, which represent the creative, generative force of the god Amun. The cow's horns signify nourishment and the protective maternal aspect of the divine, whereas the solar disk represents illumination, rebirth, and the daily cycle of death and renewal. When shown together on a goddess's headdress, all of these together convey a fusion of maternal care and solar power, visually symbolizing the idea that the goddess not only nurtures life, but also channels the sun's regenerative energy. It's like solen form, thus underscoring the INX's role as a mediator between heaven, represented by the sun, and earth, represented by the cow's horns. The headdress in total proclaims the wearer as both cosmic mother and solar queen, a guardian of life cycles, as well as upholder of universal order. The scarabaeus, which you can only just make out, at the center of the solar disk, represents the evolutionary path through the daily act of creation and rebirth. Okay, and you know, we could spend literally the rest of the session going through all of the headdresses that you find. You know, there's many of them and they're very distinctive and some of them quite interesting. But, you know, it's always a balance between too much and too little, right? So the seventh quality is the staff or wand held by the god or goddess, which has specific magical properties. For example, the lotus topped one, which is by far the most common, was used to ward off evil. The Isis head wand represented the power of Isis delegated by the goddess to to an aspect of herself, represented by another god, right? You can see how both sophisticated and complicated these ideas are. A wand headed by a hoopoe or lapwing bird symbolized gratitude, and a papyrus stem signified abundance. The eighth and final quality is what MPH calls the hieroglyphics placed around them, whether these be flowers, shrubs, small letters, or animals. Well, you know, hieroglyphics are really just the letters. The animals, flowers, and shrubs have other meanings, and we'll get into that. So at the time of the translation of the Rosetta Stone, in the early 19th century, it was discovered that the Egyptian hieroglyphs that appear throughout the Mensa Isiaca are not readable Egyptian text. They call them pseudo hieroglyphs. However, the flowers, shrubs, birds, and animals that surround the figures are symbolic. For example, the ibomorphous triad, Westcott says, S is a flying hawk. It holds a circle and a rod and refers to the power of heat supplied by the archetypal fire of the supreme mens, or the divine mind. In the Nephthian triad, the lion beneath the throne is symbol of Mumfta, or summer, and thus of the rising Nile. In general, vegetation, flowers, and fruit refers to the richness and fertility of the Nile, though certain specific plants indicate magical properties. For example, the absinthe branch, the absinthe branch, is offered to guard against putrefaction. Again, bringing it back to the idea of the underworld, the death process. Okay, next. These eight symbolic methods of portraying the secret powers of the figures are subtle reminders of the eight spiritual senses of cognition by means of which the real self in man may be comprehended. So it turns out that MPH, much later, wrote a book called The Spiritual Centers in Man. And he must have already been developing these concepts. So here he's suggesting that Kircher's eight qualities aren't just random choices, but are specifically related to eight spiritual senses of cognition. You know, DK gives us these higher senses in a treatise on cosmic fire, you know, such as clairaudience, clairvoyance, etc. Yeah, here's The Spiritual Centers in Man. You can still buy it on Amazon. This chart relates the eight qualities of the gods and goddesses in the Mensa Isiaca that we've just explored to specific inner spiritual senses that were developed, codified, you could say, later by MPH, and then finally reveals the spiritual result of using these senses. So could we get a reader to just read these horizontally, please?
Martha, can you do that for us, please?
Yes, I can. Okay. Read them for it. All right. One, form, spiritual sight, imaginative vision, sees the archetypal shape of divinity. Two, position, spatial intuition, relational awareness, and the grasp of cosmic order and one's place within it. Interrupt me anytime, Francis. Three, gesture, kinesthetic sense, inner movement, feels the living dynamic of the soul. Four, act, volitional sense, the spiritual will, knows truth through directed purpose. 5. Raiment, aesthetic sense, inner beauty, discerns the adornment of the higher self. 6. Headdress, intellectual sense, conceptual grasp, conceives the crown of spiritual authority. 7. Staff, potency, sense, dynamic power, experiences the force and protection of self. 8. Hieroglyphics, symbolic intuition, higher interpretation, reads the language of divine mysteries. I probably should have read the headings first.
Okay, everybody can see it. So these are the forms that given by Kircher that we just went through, you know, and I gave you examples of for each. And then these are the inner senses that are developed in Spiritual Centers of Man by Manly P. Hall. This is the result of using these spiritual centers. So you can see here that, you know, even though it seems like we've been on this Mitzvah Isiaka forever, that in some ways that we're really just scratching the surface. For instance, you could go back through, you know, any one of these, meanings, like for instance, the staffs, you know, and if you then apply this, the qualities represented here in this chart, and compare it to the figure carrying the staff, you know, for instance, this sense of the potency sense, dynamic power, which experiences the force and protection of self, in relation to, you know, each figure who's carrying a staff, and you get way more insight. The thing is, like I said, I think a few sessions ago, I have a I had the PDF of Westcott's interpretation of the Mincy Isiaka, where, you know, you could take that, take the picture of the Mincy Isiaka. You could also do it from this, you know, from going back over this webinar, and go way deeper than we have time to go here, even though it seems like we've, you know, we are doing a very detailed coverage of this. You could see that, in fact, if you were to apply each of these ideas and go back and consider, you know, for instance, the hawk-headed one as the archetypal shape of divinity, you know, and consider the additional meaning that this chart would bring to it. Any rate, next up.
Francis?
Yeah.
Sorry. Magda asks, could they correspond to the 8 initiations?
No, because they tend to be co-equal. You know, in other words, they're different aspects of inner spiritual senses. You know, the gods have all of these qualities associated with them at the same time, and therefore they're expressive of all these spiritual senses. Whereas the initiations are progressive, right? Now, they're also, the initiations are also qualitative, and you could look at that that way. For instance, you might associate the headdress with the third initiation because of the orientation for manas, right? To conceive the crown of spiritual authority, you know, that in that way, but there wouldn't be just a direct correlation. You could relate the form aspect to the first initiation, which is deals with, you know, the mastery of the physical plane, physical etheric plane. But I think just really, if you're going to do a deep dive into that, you would look for all of these qualities for each initiation. You know, what would the raiment of the fifth initiation look like? You know, what would be the act associated with, or the volitional sense associated with, for instance, the fourth initiation? You know, so I think in some ways they all apply to all the initiations. And of course, for the most part, this information is totally not available, but you could certainly use your imagination to explore that idea. Anyone else? Thanks for that.
Yes, we have a couple. First off, Anne Veronica shared the PDF of the Spiritual Centers in Man by Manly P. Hall.
Oh, really?
So that's in the chat for
awesome.
Anybody who would like that. And then Ariane asked, could you write the name of this tablet and its approximate date in the chat?
Yeah, I can just tell you it's considered to be, thank you for that, Anne Veronica. I didn't have it, or I would have looked more deeply into it. It's interesting because this cover is familiar. Yeah, thank you for that. Okay, it was believed to be sometime in the first 2 centuries AD, discovered in Rome, and was believed to be a Roman craftsman who created it because of the metallurgy involved. It definitely was not Egyptian. You know, even though MPH mistakenly seems to think it was, he often makes statements like it was present at the initiation of Plato, and it wasn't because it hadn't been made yet. Also, there's nothing at all like this tablet in any of the Egyptian artifacts. You know, that idea of using multiple types of metal to create a sacred object was actually explored later, you know, and the meanings of different metals, you know, it was explored in Christianity and in Neoplatonism, but not at all in Egyptian times, at least no artifacts. Facts that have been found. So yeah, and you know, if you want to jot that down on the chat, BL, you can. It's just, you know, first to second century AD Roman origins.
Okay.
Since they asked for that.
First to second centuries
AD Roman origin. Okay.
And I've got the title from the Benin Table of Isis from the advertisements we sent out. So,
okay.
There you go.
Oh, Francis, I just lost the connection and I just heard the part that you said it was done in Rome because of the metallurgy, but I missed everything else because the connection was lost. And I've lost the chat and everything. Is it possible that you just say what you said again about answering my question and spell the name of the tablet, please?
Yeah, okay. BL is putting that in the chat for you. BL, you could also write.
I just put it in the chat again, okay?
It's a Bembine tablet of Isis. Isn't there a larger name that you keep on saying, Francis?
Yeah, let me write it.
Like Menses Osiasis.
Here it is.
And it's made of metal, is what you're saying.
Here you go. Mensa Isiaka, meaning Isis, right? It's the tablet of Isis. Yeah, it's actually a much more common day name these days The Binbean tablet, it's just because there was a Cardinal Binbean that bought it in the 15th, 14th century, 15th century. He bought it and put it in his collection, but that's, that doesn't say anything about the tablet itself. So people now prefer this other title, Mensa Isiaka.
And Isis is associated with the moon, right? Because in
No,
the
she's associated with nature, with the depending at what level, the anima mundi is often associated with the Isis. In other words, the form from the highest to the lowest levels, the form aspect is often associated with Isis, and also the source of that form. So you could, in Hinduism, it's Mula Prakriti, the shining sea of undifferentiated substance and its splendor, its holiness, before it devolves into any form. That would be the root concept behind Isis.
so when you showed us that picture of the wand with the head of Isis on it, it looked like the moon was on top of it.
No, it's actually an oh that it, it's always difficult to say, just like who is actually in the what is the orb between the horns, because sometimes it's the moon, sometimes it's the sun, but the scarabaeus climbing up on the surface of the sun identifies it as the sun.
But
So
that picture of the that Phoebus or whatever Thetis, that hawk, that sort of ibis creature,
right.
two figures to the left, and he's holding a wand, and that wand has Isis, and over that wand there's a disc. Is that the sun again?
And in this whole Mensa Isiaka, Isis, right, well, first of all, I'd have to specifically look. But Isis, like in the central figure, it's definitely a solar queen, a solar being. It's a kind of queen of heaven
I see.
position, not a lunar orientation. But there are permutations of the Isian figure. Let's see here.
That was it, just the last one. Yeah, you see that one? Nope.
Yeah,
No.
that's Isis with the sun over. Also, because we know this, also because Hermes Anubis, who is this figure, is solar in his orientation. So
Okay.
that would also suggest this that. And
And
the
is there any
Uranus, see the little Uranus, that's
other?
also a solar emblem. You're bringing down solar power.
I see.
Remember, the moon is the form aspect, right? So since she's at the center of this universal depiction, she's going to represent a more cosmic aspect than simply a lunar.
I see. So she's beyond that. In this tablet, is the moon depicted on any as a god in any way?
Yeah, there are lunar deities here, especially in the lower register. This here's a crescent moon on this Sinophilus figure, but it's also holding the dark sun, which is the sun below the horizon. And then there's a star in the center of that dark sun, so you could see it's not as simple as the lunar. Here's a star in the center of a kind of solar and lunar combination.
Well, that's amazingly perceptive that you can just see those details and interpret them,
Well,
Francis.
I've been working with this. How long have we been on this? It seems like all year we've been doing
Well,
this. So finally, it's starting to sink in.
this is five. This is
Is this the
session
fifth one?
five of it.
Yeah, okay. So you go back 5 months. What's that like? 5 July 4,
Well, still.
July.
So can I just say one last thing? I really appreciate that chart that you showed, the Westcott chart, the one, yeah, that one, the one, yeah. And the reason why I appreciate that so ever so much is that it's teaching us in a very concise way how to read symbols. And so it's sort of like a basic text about how to think about an image, and it's some, the each aspect, and to begin to analyze it. So this is so appreciated, this chart.
You know,
Really,
this
thank
is the
you.
kind of thing you can go back and pull this webinar back up, and just go through the images until you find the actual here, where is it? This. You just find this on one of the slides, and you just keep going between this chart and this, and or close-ups, within this. And just really teach yourself about what's being depicted here. That's a totally possible. I mean, it was really hard for me not to go through the, especially the headdresses. The headdresses are just over the top in this thing. Are they original Egyptian? No, but they're deeply potent symbolism and well described by Westcott. But there's just, we have to draw the line somewhere. So I just, gave you a couple. And then the rest, if you want to do it, it's up to you. Okay. All right. Anyone else? Okay, next up. To express this spiritual truth, the Buddhists use the wheel with eight spokes and raise their consciousness by means of the Noble Eightfold Path. So here, quote unquote, this spiritual truth refers to the idea of eight steps by which the soul ascends to its true nature. To convey the same eightfold dynamic, Buddhists adopted the Dharma chakra, the wheel with eight spokes, with each spoke standing for one limb of the Noble Eightfold Path. These are, as you see on the right, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. But there's no, in spite of what MPH says here, there is no direct correlation between these qualities and the eight inner spiritual senses formulated by MPH, except in the fact that through the practice of the Eightfold Path, one eventually stimulates these higher senses, but they're not directly related. Okay, so you can get a little flaky in terms of, he was a 26-year-old genius, really, writing this book, but that's, it's a stretch to try to directly relate the the Eightfold Buddhist path and the and these eight inner spiritual senses. Okay, next up, the ornamental border enclosing the three main panels of the table contain many symbols consisting of birds, animals, reptiles, human beings, and composite forms. According to one reading of the table, this border represents the four elements. The creatures are elemental beings. Actually, there's so much more to these borders than just a general representation of the four elements. We're kind of used to the idea that that borders here, I'm just showing the upper part because I want to go through these, that they're just decorative. I mean, you have your main substance in the central 15 triads, and then you just do a kind of decorative, and no one would fault that, but that's not what's going on here at all. Here's the upper border broken into three parts. So This one where my cursor is the left of the top part. This is the central part of the top part, and this is the right part of the top part. Okay. So I'd like to do a quick tour of just this upper border. Again, I had to hold back from describing other elements in the border because there's some really fascinating stuff. But we'll do this just to get some idea of the wealth of symbolism contained in the borders of the Mincea Isiaca. In the following description, I've used as my basis Kircher's words with a number of clarifying words and phrases to make it easier to understand. In each case, the bottom figure is an enlarged detail of the highlighted portion of the border directly above it, which is itself a detail of the entire border above that. So, first we have a dog sitting before a sistrum and a vase of Nile water, and on either side, a lotus flower and a persea leaf, a phallus behind and before him. The lotus is a white nymphaea with narrow lily leaves. Its flowers rose, talking about here, its flowers, flower rose above the water and expanded at sunrise, and closed and sank at sunset. The pendant persea leaf is tongue-shaped. Its plant had a heart-shaped fruit. The dog is Anubis, the guardian and preserver of the phallic fecundity of Osiris. Remember that phallus was the one of 14 parts that was couldn't be found by Isis, who went searching to find the 14 parts of her husband who had been cut up. Two is a hawk with the head of Horus, the idea of terrestrial providence. Three is a lion or Moonta, the action of the fiery heat of the sun upon the earth. The winged serpent globe is the cause of all causes, the supreme mens. By now, you should know supreme mens means the divine mind. Four is the phallus oculatus, adored by Nephta, praying for fecundity. Six, with hawk head and asp body, represents a beneficent deity, symbol of light, life, and motion, acting under a bovine head representing lunar influence. Eight is a frog upon an altar living in Nile mud, who is sacred to Isis. Nine is an androsphinx or man lion with a kneeling man 10 before him. In the central portion of the upper border, right here, is a boat with the Minevus bull, that's the lunar bull, and attendants. This boat is the famous Egyptian Baris. It has a hawk figurehead, identifying it as a solar bark, solar boat, a plant of the sacred Erica, Horus with an oar, erect persea leaves, a mason's square, representing integrity, fairness, and honesty, right in front of the bull. A guardian, Isis, with a feather and a crescent moon on her head. And finally, a lotus flower is on the poop of the vessel. This boat represents the vehicle of the supreme influence passing down through all the universal paths of the world. So you could say the fact that it sits in the middle of the top border suggests that it rules over or is an expression of everything within the Mensa Isiaca. That's what's so beautiful about these kinds of symbolic tableaus. In the next portion, the worshiper is Horus. The hawk is the solar taustika, and the goat head on an altar refers to Mendes or Simondas, the Greek Pan, called by Kircher the great fertilizer. So a lot of this has to do with nature and the fecundation of creation, right? Next, we have a worshiper kneeling before
Francis.
Yes.
Sorry. Magda says the solar queen of heaven in the central box is maybe Isis, Queen Sophia, the feminine aspect of Osiris. The sacred couple is a solar deity because he, she, they come from a previous solar logos. In the central box, we see a cross surmounted by the David star, meaning sublimation of the seven planets into the sun, central of the star. They were maybe men in the first solar logos of Earth, as we are men in the second, or maybe they come from a previous cycle scheme of Earth or Venus scheme.
Yeah, interesting thoughts, really. I'll just address what you said about the IYNX, the solar queen at the central box. You could say that she's the source of Isis. She is a fundamental cosmic entity, something akin to the second logos. Isis would be a personification of that force, but the way the Mensa Ithiaca is arranged, it suggests that she is the source of everything that's happening in within the Mensa Ithiaca, right? Including all these things in the border, right? She is the point at the center of this particular circle, and this particular circle is, you know, the Mula Prakriti, the shining sea of substance that is the source of manifestation. So thanks for those ideas. I'll take a closer look at some of your concepts after. Okay, why are we here? Yeah, so next we have a worshiper kneeling before Amon as a ram. Then a vase of Nile water used at the festival of the entry of the sun into Aries. The next figure is a cynocephalus, a symbol of death, protection, and transition to the afterlife. Then we have a worshiper sitting before a wine-bearing fountain of Hecate, followed by a hawk-headed lion sphinx with a canopus. So that's, you know, just a rundown of the border. You can see how deeply you could go into the relationships between all these. Why are they placed where they're placed? What are their relations to their neighbors and to other parts of the Mensa Ithiaca? It's a huge study. You know, my guess is that this was used, you know, as a central source for spiritual study back in the early Roman times. Okay, next up, how are we doing? We still have 10 minutes, so we'll continue. According to another interpretation, the border represents the archetypal spheres, and in its frieze of composite figures are the patterns of those forms which in various combination will subsequently manifest themselves in the material world. I actually like this idea. So within the borders, you know, the visuals and the borders of the Mensa Ithiaca, there's a series of half-human, half-animal figures which embody a fusion of solar, lunar, and terrestrial archetypes, right? By mixing wings, claws, horns, and other animal parts, as well as human features, The Mincesi Eaka visually demonstrates how fundamental principles interrelate, right? It's symbolic of particular energetics forms. When these conceptual patterns manifest, they follow a coded blueprint, crystallizing into actual plant, animal, and human forms in the outer world. So you can see all the borders as the noumenal energetic sources or symbols of the noumenal energetic sources of actual plant, animal, and human forms. And then finally, the four flowers at the corner of the table are those which, because their blossoms always face the sun and follow its course across the sky, are sacred emblems of that finer part of man's nature, which delights in facing its creator. So here are the four corners enlarged. Flowers that track the sun, such as sunflowers and marigolds, have long been used in spiritual art to signify discipleship and the soul-infused personality, because they symbolize the spiritual impulse to turn towards the light and life of spirit. So even these corners aren't purely ornamental. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Kirsten, can you read
Can I
that?
ask a quick question? I'm so
Yes,
sorry.
always.
You said this is made out of metal. So, was it like a sheet of metal that was indented, or like they used like a tool to hammer it and indent it, or how was this made?
It was a sheet of copper and it was inlaid on it. Different metals were used on it. Gold, silver, more copper, iron. All I
But
don't
they
know.
use like a stylus or metal pencil to draw the lines first, right?
Let's see here. Where are we at here? We're at 151. So let's go all the way back up to the first. So here's an actual photo of just the central part. Okay. I couldn't find a high resolution photo. I worked and worked this one too, but it's still pretty blurry, So all of these, you can see the copper sheet underneath, and that all of this, like the intricacy of this borders, for instance, it's all overlay, little strips that are fashioned and colored, So these would be different metals that would be making up her wings, for instance. It's really kind of an extraordinary feat. Wouldn't you just love to have a picture of this, in the original, what it light was like before it was buried for 1500 years, but that it was ever found at all is pretty extraordinary. Okay. So, could we get a reader, please?
Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. According to the secret doctrine of the Chaldeans, the universe is divided into four states of being, planes of spheres: archetypal, intellectual, sidereal, and elemental. Each of this reveals the others, the superior controlling the inferior, and the inferior receiving influence from the superior. The archetypal plane was considered synonymous with the intellect of the triune divinity. Within this divine incorporeal and eternal sphere are included all the lower manifestations of
life, all that is, has been, or ever shall be. Within the cosmic intellect, all things, spiritual or material, exists as archetypes or divine thought forms, which is shown in the table by a chain of secrets, similes. In the middle region of the table appears the all form containing personified spiritual essence, the source and substance of all things. From this proceed the lower worlds as nine emanations in groups of three, the Ophionic, Ibimorphios, and Nephthian triads. Consider in this connection the analogy of the Kabbalistic Sephiroth, or the nine spheres issuing from Kether, the crown, the 12 governors of the universe, the Mendesian, Ammonian, Mamphtean, and Amphtean triads, vehicles for the distribution of the creative influences, and shown in the upper region of the table, are directed in the activities by the divine mind patterns existing in the archetypal sphere. The archetypes are abstract patterns formulated in the divine mind, and by them all, the inferior activities are controlled. Sorry, it was.
That's all right. It's some very difficult language. So I don't think we have time to dive into this. Let's just go ahead and announce the times, and we'll reread this next time and then move into it. There's some really interesting materials connected with this text. So we are in the first Sunday. So I think the second Friday was the first, wasn't it? So the second Friday is this coming Friday. That will be the first A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, which is
No. It's the pre-full moon.
Friday is the pre-full moon?
That's what I have, yeah. Full moon's on the 9th.
I'm glad you caught me then. So that means that we've put off TCF for a week.
Right, to the 22nd. No, to the 22nd.
Well,
4th.
No. Because the 9th, see, it's the 9th. So 7 days after the 9th is the 16th.
But they're not. It wasn't scheduled that way.
In other words, they just dropped it instead of putting it forward.
Yeah, they rearranged a bunch of other things, and we'll get to that when we get to the next secret teaching of all ages, which will be on the 31st of August.
I got to start paying more attention to these calendars because So you're saying they just dropped it. They didn't
put
it off a week. And
I didn't see that they did that when we got the schedule changes from Tuya. Let me look at the August calendar though.
Yeah.
Really quick on Moira Federation.
I'm going there now.
Yeah.
So we have.
No, the 15th is the assumption of something or other.
Drives me crazy.
Yeah, the assumption of Mary and the 24 days of Shambhala. So.
Does that conflict with the 1 o'clock? The 7 o'clock.
Yeah, it, yes.
Okay. Well, we know where the priorities are.
Right. So the next TCF is the 22nd of August.
So there'll just be one this year, this month.
Right. And the next secret teaching of all ages is the 31st, because we have a problem with the full moon again, or
the
new moon.
That part's fine.
God only knows why. Yeah. And then the next up is actually the secret doctrine on the 17th.
Okay. Okay.
Welcome to our world of scheduling. A
Yeah, you know
total
what all this tells you
nightmare.
guys is that look at this calendar. This calendar in on the BodhiFederation.com is really the or I should say usually almost all the time is the final place to determine what's going to happen and when it's going to happen, right? So check that out. But so no. Okay, yeah, the pre-full moon is this Friday, huh? Let's see.
Yeah,
I got it right here. So
the
yeah,
8th, yeah.
Friday, new moon. It says TCF. I'm
That's the
looking right at it.
22nd. That's the
Oh, that's
22nd.
22nd. Sorry, my bad. You're right. Okay, so the pre-full moon will be at 8 o'clock. 6 o'clock will be the Sirius, whatever she's doing. Okay. So, all right, c'est la vie.
Okay, and then Magda says that these flowers look like earth incarnations as Steiner painted them. And then she put the image of Steiner's below that of the. So you sh should
Okay,
maybe be able to pull
let's
there.
see, let me pull up the chat. Oh, I see, yeah. Okay. Interesting. These are the planetary seals, huh? Okay. Yeah, we see in Saturn a similar kind of flower. We'd have to do a direct comparison. Let's see here if we go back to the flowers and compare them. So they're they all look like they're six-leaved. Yeah, though they're quite different from each other. And then if we looked here, we see that the solar flower would appear to be six-leaved, whereas the Saturn flower is seven. That fits, that, but then so is the Martian flower. So are a lot of the flowers, six-leaved. But interesting. Thanks for that association. That's quite interesting. I will go with this solar flower shown here at the second grouping as being, closest. Yeah. Even though the Mercurian flower has a lot of, oh no, that's seven leaved. So that's out. So thank you, Magda. Okay, I guess that's it. So our next thing is this Friday for the pre-full moon. Hope to see you there. I always do it. A little astrological reading before, and then we talk about the Herculean labor, and I talk a little about the sign itself as well. So that's before the meditation starts at about 15 minutes into the session. So thank you all very much for attending. Be well. Appreciate you coming. We're really just hanging by a thread with this webinar series. So if you like it, keep coming. Otherwise, it's going to end. So appreciate it. Take care.
Goodbye, everybody.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.